The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. Go to clubw.com/gym, that's clubw.com/gym, and get $20 off your first order when you become a new member. Thanks, Club W. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by Scott Evest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy or girl, tons of pockets in your clothing just make everything better. Also, talk about a great Father's Day gift, To learn more and get a super special Scott Evest deal, go to jimherold.com/vest. That's jimherold.com/vest. Thanks, Scott Evest.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you today. And we have another one of these doubleheaders. Show is a little late this week. I do apologize. But again, we have double the content, so hopefully it was worth the wait. And we do have a good show for you today. Two fascinating topics that have interested me for a long time, and we never really have discussed on the 11-year history of the show, so we thought we would do it this time. First up, we're going to have a great interview with Nick Redfern, that great paranormal and UFO author. This time, he turns his attention to weapons of the gods. And then we talk about a topic that frightens me, that fascinates me. We have Dr. Jan Bondesen talking about buried alive. Spooky stuff. But first, we're going to talk to Nick about weapons of the gods. And here he is. The subject is weapons of the gods. The guest is Nick Redfern. And you know Nick from his many appearances on all types of media and his many, many books. In fact, he's the author of more than 30 books on UFOs, cryptozoology, and the world of the paranormal. And I think he's getting actually closer to 40 than he is 30. Probably by the end of the year, he'll hit 40. His books include Bloodline of the Gods, Monster Files, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, The Real Men in Black, The NASA Conspiracies, and many, many more. He's appeared on more than 70 television shows, including Ancient Aliens, UFO Hunters, Monster Quest, America's Book of Secrets, and many, many more. He's originally from the UK, but Nick has made his home near Dallas, Texas. He can be contacted at his blog over at nickredfern40n.blogspot.com. Nick, welcome to the program. So glad to have you with us. This is a fascinating subject.
Well, thanks for having me on again, Jim.
So, looking at this, the concept of this book, How Ancient Alien Civilizations Almost Destroyed the Earth, Weapons of the Gods. I think many of us are familiar with ancient aliens, of course, from the television show Ancient Astronauts, going all the way back to Eric von Däniken's theories. And I have certainly heard bits and pieces about the possibility of ancient thermonuclear war, but it's never really been covered in this level. What about this made you say, you know, this is something I've got to get into for my audience and share with them the goods on this? What kind of got you into this specific part of the ancient aliens discussion?
Well, you know, the subject of ancient astronaut reports and the history of the phenomenon, et cetera, interests me a lot. But I haven't sort of written a great deal on the subject. I wrote a book called The Pyramids and the Pentagon a few years ago, and then Bloodline of the Gods last year. But I guess the issue for me is if I'm going to write about a particular subject or aspect of ufology, you want to be able to give the reader something new and not just go over old ground and rehash somebody else's book. There's no point. So for a number of years, it was sort of quite a challenge for me to find something. And that's why I haven't really written much on the subject. But the one area, I guess, more than any other in relation to the whole ancient astronaut scenario that does interest me is this angle of ancient nuclear war, which crops up in a number of sort of ancient texts in terms of how we can interpret these ancient stories. And because it hadn't really been covered to any sort of significant degree at book length, I thought, well, why not write a book on that aspect, because it would be a completely new angle for a lot of people. And as you said, you can find aspects of these stories on the internet, but I felt that if I could put it all the information together and dig out new material and new theories and a lot of new data, and then present it all under one cover, it would be sort of a good resource tool for people who really wanted to get to grips with the ancient nuclear warfare aspect of all this.
Now, something that I think is interesting, and I know you talk about it in the book, if you look at these ancient archetypes in some are called myths of different types of disasters, a great flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, and the list goes on, Atlantis. I mean, many of these could be triggered by a nuclear war. So is that kind of where all this took you?
Yeah, that's basically the sort of the scenario that the book presents to him. The idea that, you know, we weren't the first civilization on the planet to develop atomic weapons. And I kind of take two approaches to it. One is the scenario of extraterrestrials themselves provoking these ancient nuclear wars. And the other angle is the theory of, well, were there also highly advanced humans living tens of thousands of years ago, and maybe also having interaction with extraterrestrials? So it could be a little bit of both, that, you know, there are extraterrestrial sort of turf wars fought on the planet itself, but also some of this technology may have been shared with certain aspects of the human race as well, who, you know, sort of did the unthinkable and destroyed themselves. So there are sort of various aspects to this story. But you're right, you can find throughout most cultures stories of massive worldwide cataclysms. I mean, the flood stories, for example, you know, you can find those all over the place, from Native American history to the Bible story, obviously, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and all sorts of things that talk about ancient floods and, you know, the planet being pummeled and destroyed and the people having to start over again. And as I point out in the book, and things like Sodom and Gomorrah, as I point out in the book, you know, we can place these accounts not just in the sort of the realm of folklore or mythology, but of some sort of worldwide cataclysm. But, you know, if we were to go down that path today, we would probably create the sort of same damage to the planet that's on a worldwide scale that, you know, these so-called floods and cataclysms did tens of thousands of years ago. So we can make a case that perhaps the destruction way back when was provoked by the sort of same weapons that we might use one day.
It's interesting because there's one passage in here that's particularly chilling. It's from some of the ancient Indian texts and talking about an India war. And it talks about flying a swift and powerful Vimana, hurled a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe. I won't read it all, but it talks about the destruction. It says the corpses were so burned as to be unrecognizable. Now listen to this, and you know it because you wrote it. Their hair and nails fell out. Pottery broke without any apparent cause, and the birds turned white. After a few hours, all foodstuffs were infected. To escape from the fire, the soldiers threw themselves in streams to wash themselves and all their equipment. Wow, that sounds like nuclear and radiation contamination, if anything does. That's pretty striking. Can you talk about that passage and what surrounds that?
Yeah, well, that actually comes from, that's like an English translation of an ancient text called the Mahabharata. And it's sort of one of the earliest and sort of most renowned, if you like, ancient Sanskrit writings. And Sanskrit is the language of Hinduism. And it's this huge manuscript, actually about three times the length of the Bible. So yeah, that gives you some sort of indication of how extensive, you know, the story is that it tells. But basically, the Mahabharata tells a story of a war called the Kurukshetra War, which was fought in northern India in an area called Haryana. And there's a great deal of debate as to when the events that are described in the Mahabharata actually occurred. For example, in 2003, the Mythic Society in Bangalore actually had a conference that debated this issue of how far back the text or the story that's told in the Mahabharata went. And theories were sort of around about 1500 BC, and other experts suggested 3000 BC. Others suggested 6000 BC. And it's also been suggested that possibly the Mahabharata actually tells or inherited, if you like, an even older story of events that might have occurred tens of thousands of years ago. Now, given the time frame, you would expect that a war between two warring factions in northern India would have been fought with sort of swords, shields, on horseback, you know, cannons possibly even, that kind of thing. But certainly not mysterious flying craft known as Vimana, which was what they were called, and these strange stories of iron thunderbolts destroying cities and contamination and widespread death. You're right, it does actually, you know, when you read some of the translations, it does push it down that pathway. And the fact that it comes from, you know, an ancient manuscript is very, very intriguing. Now, what's also intriguing is that the two families, the warring families, were called the Pandavas and the Kauravas. You know, they were humans. So if ancient aliens did come to the Earth and brought nuclear weapons, then a case could be made, as strange as it sounds and as controversial as it sounds, that some of this technology was shared with some of the more powerful human societies that existed at the time, such as these in northern India. And maybe they were taught, you know, the nature of the technology and then misused it. So, you know, it becomes a complicated story when we see it's not just as simple as possibly ancient aliens fighting turf wars on the planet with atomic weapons, but some of this technology actually in the hands of the ancients, the human ancients as well. And certainly there's no doubt that when it comes to this issue of ancient nuclear warfare, the story of the Mahabharata is probably one of the most relevant ones for people who've sort of studied this particular issue.
Well, it is fascinating. We are talking with Nick Redfern about his new book, Weapons of the Gods, How Ancient Alien Civilizations Almost Destroyed the Earth. And we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Club W. Now, before we get back to the show, I do want to give them a shout out because they have reintroduced me to the world of wine, and I used to be intimidated by wine and people who loved wine. I thought, this is beyond me. This is above me. You know, this is a people of culture. And I learned through Club W that it's very easy to learn about wine and just simply get what you like at a very reasonable price, because Club W is targeting a new generation of wine drinkers who want to do away with all that pretense and simply enjoy, as I said, reasonably priced great wine. Club W custom tailors wines to the tastes of the individual, and they deliver 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for only $39 plus a $6 shipping rate. So go over to clubw.com/Jim and take the 20-second palate profile quiz to get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. So it's very quick, 20 seconds. And they just ask you about things that you like, different foods you like, and they figure out what kind of wines you like. Now, the price point for most wines is $20. And Club W is offering audience members who are over 21 and live in the U.S. a $20 credit on their first order of 3 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. So basically, you're getting your first bottle of wine for free. Now, I've been enjoying a bottle of Wonderful Wine Company. That's the name of the one, Wonderful Wine Company. And I love some of the kitschy titles. They have a great selection over there. You've really got to go check it out. To receive that $20 credit on your first order, go over to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim. It's a new way of drinking wine, a new way of enjoying wine with family and friends. I think you're going to love it. I love it. Check it out at clubw.com/Jim and get $20 off your first order, a free bottle of wine. Thanks, Club W. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Nick Redfern. The book is Weapons of the Gods, How Ancient Alien Civilizations Almost Destroyed the Earth. Now, Nick, in the book, continuing on this theme about India, you have a chapter here called Top Guns Over Ancient India. Is there reason to think that an ancient Tom Cruise was over the skies, kind of like fighter pilots battling it out over ancient India?
Well, that's why I actually titled the chapter Top Guns Over Ancient India, because some of the interpretations of the story of the Mahabharata and other ones like the Ramayana, for example, more than any other, actually talks about the idea that these ancient wars fought in northern India actually were involving some sort of aerial craft that have become known as Vimanas. Now, the Ramayana itself, this ancient text, is probably the most relevant one, because it talks about the god Rama actually fighting sort of aerial battles between so-called gods and demons in the skies of the earth. And there's no doubt that when you sort of read this, you know, it talks about sort of massive annihilation and, you know, these sort of terrible widespread wars, etc. And of course, you know, this sort of begs the question as to what these Vimanas were. And one of the people who sort of dug really deeply into this, who I talk about in the book, was David Hatcher Childress. And David has sort of written and researched this extensively, and talks about how some of the old ancient texts describe sort of like a multi-decked round craft with portholes, which sounds very much like sort of a classic flying saucer type craft. So that sort of, you know, opens our eyes even a little bit more. And but certainly the most relevant text, if you like, is one that in English translates as Science of Aeronautics, written by, in the early part of the 20th century, by a man named Pandit Sastry. And his book's an interesting one, but it's also controversial, because he claimed that the material was sort of channeled through to him rather than actually sort of researching it, you know, through ancient history, etc. But he talked extensively about these, the Vimana, and how they could take to the skies and had incredible powers and, you know, could sort of fly and shoot across the sky, etc., etc. And so when you find a lot of these ancient texts and stories talking about aerial warfare in ancient India, you know, for me at least, it's kind of like the situation of there's no smoke without fire. Mm-hmm. There's clearly something was going on in the skies of India. Possibly, you know, somebody either inherited or was given or uncovered the secrets of flight, and not just sort of, you know, balloons or, you know, gliders or something like that, but things that actually seem highly advanced and highly destructive as well.
You know, and I don't know if you cover it in the book, but I think it was on Ancient Aliens one time, there was a golden figure, a small figure that looked like it was the shape of a almost like a modern fighter jet. And it's a very vague recollection. Did you run across anything like that? Because I seem to recall something being shown like that in relation to India that folks might have thought represented, you know, something very similar to the craft we have today.
Yeah, there actually are a few sort of curious remnants and sort of designs and little figures, etc., that have been found over the years that do look like aircraft. There's some from South America. And when you look at them, you know, because they've got like a tail fin, you know, they don't look like birds. It's not like somebody's made a little model of a bird. It actually looks like sort of the classic design of an aircraft with, you know, stabilizers, wings, tail, etc., etc. And I do talk about this in the book. And one of the things I point out is that it looks like somebody fashioned these little devices, if you like, or pieces of jewelry out of actually witnessing and seeing real life versions, and was just inspired to make a model of them, you know, in the same way that kids play with model airplanes today. And of course, that begs the question, well, what were they seeing in the sky? You know, was it solely extraterrestrial military craft, or was it something that had been shared with, you know, the powerful kings of India, perhaps, you know, way back when? So there's a lot of questions, but there's also a lot of intriguing data as well.
Now, if there were a nuclear war, I would expect two things you would find. You would find some kind of wreckage, whether it's wreckage of missiles or, well, I guess if it totally melts in it. But you know what I'm saying, some kind of almost military equipment. And then on the other hand, I would think that you would find remnants of radiation, higher than expected natural radiation in a particular place. If it had, in fact, even thousands of years ago been hit by a nuclear bomb, you would think that some of that would certainly linger. Have either of those things been uncovered in any way in any of your research?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're two important questions because, I mean, if we sort of draw a parallel with our civilization today, you know, we're sort of spread far and wide all across the entire planet. And even if we had sort of a completely devastating nuclear war that destroyed our civilization, and even if it took 15,000 years, you know, for the human race to start over again and build up, you know, because there would just be massive death and destruction, you know, it would take thousands of years. But even, say, 15,000 years later, with all of our technology and the way we've spread across the planet, there would still be a lot of remnants left. You know, there would be sort of rusted remains of old vehicles and buildings, and people would be finding all over the place, you know, just remnants of things that hadn't sort of degraded over time, like things made of metal and things like that. Sure. So clearly the people, you know, 20,000 years from now would know that there were people who came before them and who had a great deal of technological data, even if they didn't know who we were, you know, that the story of our civilization had been lost and forgotten. But we don't actually have that with these ancient stories. So, you know, the skeptics would say, well, that's because there were no atomic nuclear wars. And but my view is a bit different to that, or significantly different, I should say. I think when we look at these stories, we're not seeing a civilization like ours, which was worldwide and massive in scope. What we're seeing is sort of localized areas where there may have been highly advanced civilizations, but that was certainly not the case all across the planet. We're talking predominantly like about India, Pakistan, Middle East, Egypt, and portions of Africa, and some portions of South America. And so in other words, if these were relatively small pockets of highly advanced people also interacting with extraterrestrials, and if they destroyed themselves, then it's entirely possible that there wouldn't be much left, because, you know, we kind of think of our civilization on a massive scale. It sounds a bit of a paradox, but imagine a highly advanced ancient civilization, but in number, which was actually quite small. And I think that is probably the one way to sort of rationalize and explain why we don't have that much left. Now, in terms of the radiation issue that you brought up, one of the really interesting things is not so much related to radiation, but when the first atomic bomb was tested in New Mexico just before the two bombs were dropped on Japan, there was this test at a place called the Trinity Site in New Mexico out in the desert, because nobody really knew what was going to happen when the bombs were detonated. And so they had this trial run, so to speak. And one of the unforeseen side effects of the testing of the first atomic bomb in July 1945 in New Mexico was that the sheer incredible temperatures provoked by the explosions actually turned the sandy desert floor into a glass-like substance, which became known as trinitite. And it became known as trinitite because the area where they tested the bomb was called the Trinity Site. So this weird substance, which is like, if you Google a trinitite, you'll see these pictures of this glassy, greenish, bluish, and also other colored glassy substance. But it occurs when the temperature gets so hot that the sand vitrifies and becomes glassy. And what's really interesting is that, which sort of partly answers your question, is that ancient equivalents of trinitite have been found, for example, in Egypt, in Libya, in other portions of the Middle East, in Arabia, and it's almost identical to the trinitite found at the site of the explosion in New Mexico in 1945. So although it's not today, of course, thousands of years later, radioactive, as we understand it, it does demonstrate that in these particular areas, extremely high heat had somehow, and for reasons we don't understand, radically altered the desert floors in areas such as Libya. And the best comparison is to look at what happened in New Mexico. The trinitite in New Mexico is almost identical with the similar substance found throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating when you kind of see these different things that kind of say are what I like to call head scratchers. That kind of like, I'm not sure that's what that means, but it means something. It just didn't come from absolutely thin air. Now, you even talk in here about the possibility that some of these things happened in what we now know as the United States. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when it comes to things like, you know, ancient nuclear warfare, even sort of like a brief, you know, check of the internet will sort of show that stories like relating to the Middle East and the Mahabharata in India, you know, they're the ones that sort of really stand out for a lot of people. But one of the lesser known aspects that you just mentioned is this whole angle of destruction in the United States. And as amazing as it might sound, we actually find a lot of interesting data in support of this. For example, we don't know how it happened, but we do know for sure that in the Great Lakes area, known as the Great Lakes Basin, which covers the states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, New York, and Minnesota, we know that probably somewhere roughly around about 13 to 14,000 years ago, that entire area was subject to what's known as particle bombardments and intense irradiation of the landscape. Now, theories have been put forward along the lines of, well, this must have been due to meteorite strikes or powerful comets or something like that. But again, if we place it in the context of all these ancient stories of cataclysms and worldwide destruction, and then we find that exactly the same thing went on in the United States, or what is the United States today, I should say, but sort of 12 to 13 to 14,000 years ago, and there was intense irradiation, then again, we can place this into sort of a concept of a nuclear war. And when people say, well, it was comets or it was meteorites, one of the questions I always ask is, well, if we had all these meteorites and comets hitting the planet 12,000 years ago and 5,000 years ago, why aren't they doing it now? You know, yes, we get meteorite strikes, and every now and again you'll see, like on the news, there's like a meteorite soaring through the sky all lit up. But why is it we aren't getting these gigantic meteorites and comets, which we're told caused massive destruction 10, 15, 20, 30,000 years ago? It's like they've suddenly gone away, which really doesn't make sense if it's just down to random strikes from meteorites, etc. So that leaves it open, wide open for me, you know, the idea that the United States, you know, could have been hit. And perhaps that area, the Great Lakes Basin, which we know was heavily irradiated at one point, that maybe the lakes themselves were literally sort of carved out by the results of, you know, some sort of ancient war.
Now, in terms of implications for today, I think that's one of the neat things about this book, is even if you don't believe what this book says, in other words, you think, there wasn't any ancient alien nuclear war, I think it's kind of a good reminder, because I think that there's this feeling, and you talk about a little bit at the beginning of the book, that, oh, well, that nuclear war thing, that's something that they worried about, you know, in the 1960s and 70s and 80s with the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and the evil empire and all of those things people our age know very well. But the thing is that I think people forget that there's a ton of nuclear weapons armed and ready to go right now. And you have the issue of proliferation. You know, as tough as the Cold War was, you know, the Soviet Union, love it or hate it, was pretty stable. The United States, love it or hate it, I happen to love it, but it was pretty stable. So you kind of knew who your enemy was, and you knew the trigger points, and you had a hotline after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and things were kind of under control, although there were some really scary incidents. One in particular, I believe, there was a full-scale false alarm, and it looked to the Soviets like we were attacking them, and if one particular man would have followed his training, we probably would all be dust right now. But anyway, nevertheless, I think we think that's all in the past. But nuclear war is something that unfortunately could still happen and may very well still happen. We hope not, but it might happen.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, the Cold War worked well in the sense that despite all the sort of bravado and flexing of muscles and et cetera, the Soviets, the United States, the UK, NATO and the Warsaw Pact and the Chinese, everybody knew that despite all the shouting and at each other, they see, you know, deep down they all knew that no one could win a nuclear war. You know, I mean, it's a matter of fact and science that, you know, say, for example, one side decided to launch a sneak attack on the other. Well, everybody, you know, in the major advanced nations has spy satellites in orbit, and they're, you know, they have the ability to read the heat signatures on like missile silos. So as soon as the doors open, that alerts them. When they see, you know, the heat coming from the missiles as they're about to be launched, every nation, you know, can anticipate that and tell that the other nation is going to attack them. So their missiles would be flying before the other sides even reach that country. So in other words, no one can win a nuclear war. It's impossible. And, you know, even today with the end of the Cold War and certainly the dismantling of a certain number of nuclear weapons, the major powers on the planet, like the United States, Russia, and China, have enough atomic weapons between them to destroy the world. Well, not destroy the world, but to destroy civilization numerous times over. But you're right, what we have to worry about today is the fact that the world is so unpredictable. And whereas before, you know, you were fighting, like the Second World War, we're fighting the Germans and the Japanese, and we know what sort of uniforms they wore, and we knew what sort of uniforms, you know, they knew what sort of uniforms we were wearing. So, you know, you recognize the enemy. Today, the enemy could be your next-door neighbor. And then, of course, when you've got fears of things like dirty bombs, and for people who don't know what dirty bombs are, people think they're atomic weapons. They're actually not. You know, an atomic bomb, a nuclear bomb, explodes and creates massive devastation by the splitting of the atom. A dirty bomb is basically where a person gets their hands on radioactive materials and it's sort of incorporated into a regular bomb. So what happens is that the bomb explodes and it just showers radioactive material here, there, and everywhere. So it's actually quite different to an atomic bomb, but the outcome is the same, is that the area becomes irradiated and a no-go zone. So, you know, that's one of the big worries we have today, is that, you know, some crazy person's going to get their hands on, you know, radioactive material and then, you know, let it loose in downtown, you know, downtown part of some major city or whatever, which would, you know, be disastrous. It would kill, even, I mean, the radiation would probably kill, you know, depend on how many people in the air, it could be thousands, and it could make that particular, you know, couple of square miles totally a no-go zone for the next 25 years or something, you know.
Yeah, it's really, really quite frightening. So, I mean, when you take a look at the weapons of the gods, you also talk about Egypt. And we've talked a lot about India. We've talked about a little bit about the U.S. But what did you find about Egypt?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book, I don't just focus on, for example, atomic weapons. I talk about all sorts of different technologies. And, of course, one of the big stories that comes out of the Bible in relation to Egypt in the book of Exodus is the story of the 10 biblical plagues, which essentially focused around God's wrath, allegedly because the Pharaoh refused to release the Israelites from their state of what was known as bondage. And so God essentially said, well, if you're not going to release the Israelites, I'm going to hit back at you. And so you have these 10 plagues. Excuse me. And one of the things I point out is that the way in which the plagues broke out and the nature of them is actually eerily similar to some of the science we're working on today. I mean, give you a classic example. There's one particular story in the story of the plagues of Egypt, where supposedly the River Nile was turned to blood. Now, what's interesting is that in the summer of 2001, something very similar happened at a place called Kerala in western India, and red rain started to fall all across the area, and nobody could figure out what this actually was. But one particular theory that came out of the Mahatma Gandhi University in Kottayam was the idea that something, had essentially some sort of microbes, had got hitched to the tail of a comet as it was passing close to the Earth, and had sort of spread and survived the journey through the atmosphere, and it affected the local rain to the point where it would actually turn it red, and that it was some sort of possibly even some sort of like microbiological material. So in other words, we have a relatively recent, you know, just 2001 example of red rain falling and changing the water, you know, into a red color with an extraterrestrial component, in this case, a comet. Now, we also have the stories, for example, of the plagues of gnats, flies, and locusts, which appear in the Bible. And I point out in the book that as far back as the Second World War, the Nazis were secretly working to infect all sorts of different insects with highly dangerous viruses and diseases like cholera, typhus, yellow fever, and plague. And the plan was that if Hitler had ever managed to conquer Europe and make his way to the United States, the plan was to sort of decimate the nation by aerosol droppings of, you know, viruses, but also releasing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of insects across the landscape to, you know, sort of instill typhus, cholera, plague, etc., and, you know, wipe out the population that way. So, in other words, there's, you know, things like that. And one of the more telling ones as well was when how supposedly the skies over Egypt were turned black. You know, it's almost like a continual stormy and dark environment. And but I also point out that today we're doing research to essentially weaponize the weather. Just a few years ago, for example, the Air Force released a report called the 2025 report, which was a study of where the Air Force wanted to be in 2025. And one of the areas dealt with what was called owning the weather, the idea of actually being able to create things like tornadoes and earthquakes, and direct them on the territory of your enemy. So, you know, you would be able, there would be sort of plausible deniability. Well, it was nothing to do with us. It was just down to Mother Nature. So when we put all these issues together, we do find some very sort of weird parallels between the various 10 plagues in the Bible and our science and technology today.
Nick, where can people find this book, and where can they find information about everything else you're doing? Because I know that you've got a ton of other books coming out, all the great legacy work you've done in the past, the great articles you've written for us over at jimherold.com for the Paranormal Brain Trust, and you write for many other sites. Where can people plug into everything you do in this book specifically?
Well, people can reach me at my blog, which is nickredfernfortean, nickredfernfortean.blogspot.com, or they can type me into Facebook, or they can reach me at Twitter, nickredfernufo. As for my books, they're all available on Amazon, and a good percentage of them you can also get off the shelves in Barnes & Noble as well.
Very good. Our guest has been Nick Redfern. The book is Weapons of the Gods, How Ancient Alien Civilizations Almost Destroyed the Earth. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim.
It was great to have some time to talk to Nick about his latest book. It is hard to keep up. He writes so many, and I know he has a few more coming out this year, and we'll have him back on the show for those. Fascinating subject, fascinating guy, and a great guy. And next up, we have another fascinating subject. I've always been interested in this, the topic of being buried alive. Is there anything scarier? I don't know. But we're going to find out. We're going to talk to Dr. Jan Bondesen about the subject right now on the Paranormal Podcast. He wrote a book quite a few years ago. It was best-selling. It was called Buried Alive, The Terrifying History of Our Most Primal Fear. I'm talking about Jan Bondesen. He is a senior lecturer at Cardiff University. He lived in London for many years and spent decades studying the criminal history of the metropolis. Now, his latest book is on that, The Murder Houses of London. His many critically acclaimed books include Queen Victoria's Stalker, Amazing Dogs, Amazing Freaks, the Pig-Faced Lady of Manchester Square and Other Medical Marvels, The Cabinet of Medical Curiosities, The London Monster, and again, the book we're going to talk about today, Buried Alive, The Terrifying History of Our Most Primal Fear. Jan Bondesen, welcome to the program today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So when you decided to write this book, and we're talking about a book that was out in the early 2000s but has maintained its popularity, why did you decide to tackle this particular topic?
Well, I had an essay about the subject of apparent death and premature burial in my 1997 book, Cabinet of Medical Curiosities. And in 1999, the Discovery Channel made a documentary about the risk of being buried alive, and I took part in it. I was filmed at the Kensal Green Old Cemetery in London, where I lived in those days. And one of the editors at the W.W. Norton Publishers in New York had seen the documentary. So they signed up a contract for me to do a full-length book about the subject.
Now, in terms of being buried alive, I mean, it may be somewhat obvious, but why is that really one of our greatest fears? I mean, I think that many might fear that more than death itself. Why is it our most primal fear?
Because of the utter helplessness of a person buried alive down there in a coffin, 6 feet under, apart from the rest of humanity. It is indeed a primal fear, and the earliest instances of concern for premature burial can be found already in classical times, and it became more common in the 17th century, and then there was a wholesale epidemic of fear of being buried alive in the 1740s.
Now, is it true that at one point as many as 10 out of 100 people were buried alive?
Well, we must consider, and under that circumstance, that there was quite a movement of anti-premature burial propagandists active in Europe back in the old days, and they wrote pamphlets and they estimated how many people got buried alive through their careless doctors diagnosing them as dead, and they stated that 1 out of 100, 1 out of 20, or even 1 out of 10 people who were put in a coffin and buried were actually dead. But those were exaggerations caused by their obvious desire to plead their cause or argue for burial reform.
Now, I just thought of this, and I'm sure it's not an original thought. I'm sure you've covered it in the book, but would this be a rather diabolical way to murder someone, to make them somehow appear as though they were dead and have them buried prematurely and basically murder them under the ground?
Well, that would be rather difficult today, and it would be difficult even in the old days, and I don't know of any case in criminal history of that actually happening, although it has happened in quite a few books. I think there was a film version of one of Poe's stories, The Premature Burial, that had such a topic, and it also occurs in one of Sheridan Le Fanu's short stories, where a wealthy Englishman was drugged by a gang of French bandits who planned to have him buried alive.
Now, how did, I mean, the thing is that, you know, we don't go around digging up bodies that much, at least I think the general public is aware of. How were these cases of being buried alive found? I mean, in most cases, nobody would ever know. What was the evidence? How do we know that this was happening?
Well, if you look at the pamphlets from the 19th century, the much is often made of scratches inside a coffin made by the desperate buried alive person trying to claw their way out. And there are also instances of corpses having turned over in the coffin. But those kinds of cases are probably due to putrefactic changes post-mortem, because the human body becomes quite bloated and swollen after death inside the coffin. So that can definitely account for the body changing position. But there have been a few bona fide cases of people being buried alive. There was one from the 1860s in France where a young woman had been diagnosed dead with cholera by some person. It doesn't say who, whether it was a clergyman or whether it was a doctor. But when she was put in a coffin, and the coffin was to be buried, but just when they were starting to shovel the earth onto the coffin, she knocked on the coffin lid. The coffin was taken up, and the woman was found to be alive, although she died a few days later. So here we have a bona fide case verified by a doctor who examined her after she was taken out of the coffin, of a person being diagnosed dead, put inside a coffin, and then through a great stroke of luck, she is saved in the last minute. There's also a German case from the 1820s, where again a German laboring man was buried and the earth was shoveled down onto his coffin, and then they heard him again knocking or making a noise inside of the coffin. So they started removing all the earth again, and they took him out of the coffin. And when he was taken out, he was still alive, and he bled freely when they opened the vein, a sign that he had really been alive there down in the coffin. So there are a few good cases from the old days of people being buried alive by mistake, and one wonders how many who actually were not discovered in time, so they were woke up down there in the coffin to have a horrid struggle, trying desperately to save themselves in the hopeless situation.
Now, is it true that the expression "saved by the bell" that came in regard to this particular happenstance in terms of being buried alive?
Well, that's a question I've been asked many times by American interviewers, and the answer is no. I can find no evidence that that is the case, although there were a variety of security coffins back in Victorian times, both in Britain and in Europe and in the United States, where there was various forms of signaling machinery. So a prematurely buried person down in the coffin could turn a lever or pull a string, and that would set a bell ringing and a flag waving above earth through a mechanism looking rather like an American mailbox on top of the coffin. So, and there was quite a variety of these security coffins in the old days, particularly from Germany, where there was a great fear of being buried alive, with quite intricate mechanisms. But the problem was that they were too sensitive, so if the corpse became bloated during the process of putrefaction, it would set the mechanism off, and a perfectly dead person would be exhumed by mistake.
Was there ever a case where actually it did save someone, a documented case?
There is no documented case of that happening. And the same goes for the so-called hospitals of the dead that they had in Germany in those days. They were called the Leichenhäuser, so the houses for the dead. So in temperate climate, corpses were incubated inside a large corpse room with strings tied to the fingers and toes so that the slightest movement would sound an alarm. And then they were incubated in the Leichenhaus, the hospital for the dead, until they were putrid. and putrefaction was considered a 100% certain sign of death. So once they were had started to putrefy, they could be buried, but not before that had happened. And there were such hospitals for the dead all over Germany, and in Austria, and there was one in The Hague in Holland. And don't think there were any in France, but there was one in Copenhagen. There's none in Britain where people poo-pooed the idea of being buried alive. And last year in December, I went to Vienna in Austria, and I visited the Bestattungsmuseum, so the museum for funerary history. And they have the only remaining signaling apparatus from a hospital for the dead, tied around the arm of the patient inside the hospital, so that the slightest movement would make a bell ring. So a Rettungswecker, it is called, a bell to save the apparently dead person. And it had once been in a small Leichen house just outside Vienna.
Well, it is a fascinating topic. We'll be back with Jan Bondesen more about Buried Alive right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Scott eVest. Whether you're a ghost hunter or a gadget guy or girl, tons of pockets in your clothing. Well, they just make everything better. And also, they are great Father's Day gifts, whether you're talking about their jackets or their vests or pants or all the different pocket-laden clothing that they have. Now, I love Scott eVest. I have several of their creations. I have their Quest vest, which is fantastic. I think it has over 40 pockets. It's amazing. I have their System 8, which is basically two jackets in one, and that's great for the cold, cold winter time. And then you can break them apart and use the jacket, for example, when it's a little cooler. And then I also have their pack jacket now, which is their lightweight jacket, which is great for this time of year. And that's just the surface. I have three different products, and that's just the beginning. Actually, I forgot. I also have their pullover hoodie, which is my go-to hoodie now. I love it. And the thing is that I'm not the only one. Because I love on their site, they have a graphic that shows, it says they've sold over 10 million pockets. I love that. It's not by units, it's by pockets. The thing is, guys, if you are looking for a Father's Day gift, this is truly one you ought to get because it is unique. It is something different. How many times have you seen Dad struggle with finding a place for his glasses, finding a place for his phone, finding a place for his wallet? Well, you don't have to do that anymore. You've got the perfect, unique Father's Day gift with Scott eVest. And as I said, you're talking about vests, jackets, hoodies, pants, shirts, tees, and polos. It just is endless, the kind of permutations they have found for pockets. And it's not just about guys. All those same things apply, vests, jackets, hoodies, pants, and shirts, for the ladies in our audience too. So don't feel left out. So whether you are a lady out there buying for yourself, or maybe you're buying for the dad in your life, it's a great thing. It is a fantastic thing. I highly recommend them. Go over to jimherald.com/vest. You'll find the links there to jump over to their site, and then use the special discount code JimHerald, one word, to get 20% off your Scott eVest purchase. I love Scott eVest. You will love Scott eVest. Dad will love Scott eVest. Get Scott eVest. Thanks, Scott eVest. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. The subject is being buried alive, specifically the book Buried Alive, The Terrifying History of Our Most Primal Fear. Our guest is the author, Jan Bondesen. Now, how does this continue to the current day? Obviously, with embalming and so forth, once you're embalmed, that's it. So that's not a worry. But does it kind of transfer over to maybe ending up in a morgue prematurely, or perhaps maybe if somebody is a donor, organ harvesting prematurely? How has this kind of, is this fear still exist, but just in a different form?
Well, that's a complex question. Firstly, The thing about embalming and cremation, one reason that embalming and cremation became quite popular in late Victorian times was the fear of being buried alive. But then from modern times, you have the story of the coffin going into the crematorium oven and then a terrible scream is heard. So there are drawbacks with that method as well. So embalming is, of course, a certain method of to avoid being buried alive, but you don't want to be roasted alive in a crematorium either, do you?
No.
So the fear of being buried alive is actually today a psychiatric disease. So things have changed so very much that being abnormally concerned with the risk of being buried alive by mistake is actually called taphophobia. So it's one of these neurotic phobia disorders. And there have been cases described well into modern times. And recently there was a case report in an Irish medical journal about elderly people who asked to have an artery cut after death or had to have their heart taken out to avoid being buried alive.
Wow.
So the fear is still with us and perhaps not all that irrationally, because there have been a number of near misses even in recent times. For example, in this country in the 1970s, a drug addict in Surrey was declared dead by a doctor, and he was put in a coffin. And when the coffin lid was screwed down, he knocked at the coffin lid.
Wow.
So he had suffered from a condition known as hypothermia. He had taken an overdose of drugs outdoors in freezing cold weather, and that had made him extremely death-like. And there's also a well-verified instance from this country in the 1980s of a diabetic woman being mistakenly diagnosed as dead. And then they discovered in the ambulance on the way to the morgue that she was actually alive. And she might well be still alive today. The careless doctor was fined, as she ought to be. And when I did interviews for Buried Alive with American Radio back in 2001, when the book was out, all the journalists asked me about a recent case from New York State where a coroner had declared a woman dead after a drugs overdose, and she woke up in a body bag inside the morgue.
Wow. Wow. Now, are the signs of death, I think most of us think, oh, your heart stops beating, your brain waves go flat, you're dead, that's it. But is it true that the signs of death are more subtle? And also, as medical science progresses, is that line changing, the line of death?
Well, we must remember that the sophisticated medical machinery is only available to a relatively small part of humanity, and that in parts of South America and Africa and Asia, the procedure of declaring a person dead is done by a village doctor without even electrocardiography available. And also electrocardiography is not a certain way of diagnosing a person dead, because there is a condition called exudative pericarditis, where there is a large accumulation of fluid in the heart sac outside of heart that makes an ECG go flatline, even though the heart is actually still operating. Of course, an electroencephalography is quite a certain way of declaring people dead, but that is an expensive procedure and it cannot be routinely made use of even in America. So in parts of there were definite cases of people being buried alive by mistake in Europe in Victorian times, and there may well be other instances in the developing world today.
In terms of the fiction, you talked a little bit about Poe. Where other in fiction has this kind of theme been taken advantage of as kind of a device of fright?
Well, Poe was, of course, the great writer about people being buried alive by mistake, but he really reacted to the medical topics of his time, rather like a present-day author using AIDS and HIV as a metaphor. Because in Poe's time, the Americans were quite frightened of being buried alive by mistake. And the burial alive theme occurs in quite a few books of the time, from Romeo and Juliet onwards to a variety of fictional work. And Poe used it, of course, in his story, The Premature Burial, but it also occurs in The Fall of the House of Usher and a number of other stories. Poe was quite obsessed with the premature burial topic. So it occurs in Berenice and also in quite a few of his other books about people being a violated grave, a disfigured body, found still breathing, still palpitating, still alive, he quotes in Berenice. So Poe's obsession with premature burial was echoed by a German contemporary of his, a learned lady named Friederike Kempner. And she wrote a lot of poetry, and she also wrote poems about people being buried alive. And in the Franco-Prussian War, she asked King Wilhelm for permission to go to the front and examine the bodies of the German soldiers so they were really dead before they were buried. She had no similar concerns about the French soldiers, we might add. And she wrote a poem, "In the German races, fight for land to live in. Those pale heroic faces of the dead may still be living. Great Emperor, with France enslaved, remember it is surely a dismal end to soldiers brave to be buried prematurely."
Go ahead.
So she wrote a variety of premature burial poetry, including a long poem called "The Prematurely Buried Child," ending with a plea for hospitals for the dead to be constructed all over Germany, so that people would be spared this dismal fate. So Hans Christian Andersen, the Danish children's novelist, he was very frightened of being buried alive. So when traveling on the continent, he always used to bring with him a large paper sheet carrying the text, "I'm not really dead, call a competent doctor." And in the same will that had the foundation of the Nobel Prize, the great Swede Alfred Nobel, he also wanted 3 days to go before he was between being declared dead and being buried, and also an artery opened. So quite a few people in those days, and quite a few famous people as well, had a fear of being buried alive, including the French author Guy de Maupassant, who used the premature burial theme for in quite a few of his stories, including one called Le Tic, or the spastic mannerism, where the narrator meets a Frenchman with prematurely white hair who has come to a spa in France with his invalid daughter, and he had a spastic mannerism of his hand, like he wanted to shove some person away. And the story behind this was that his daughter Juliette had died from some strange variety of heart disease, and one day she had collapsed and couldn't be revived, and she was buried in the family vault. And when returning home after the funeral, the distraught father dismissed his old valet, and he sat all night in front of the fireplace mourning the daughter, and then the doorbell rang, and it was the daughter coming back from the morgue. And it turned out that it was the old valet who had actually dug her up from the vault and then cut off one of her fingers to steal a valuable ring, and the blood flow from the amputation had restored her to life. And the spastic mannerism was the result of the father trying to shove away this ghost, as he believed it was. And when the domestic saw the girl alive, he opened his mouth in a gasp of horror and fell backwards, stone dead. So death must have his victim, although it's not always the intended one. And this story with the Lady of the Ring is an urban legend that spread throughout the world from the 14th century until the present day in many different varieties.
Now, here's a question for you. It seems like periodically from time to time you'll hear these accounts of in a third world country where embalming isn't common, of somebody being at their funeral and reviving out of their coffin. Now, is that overblown or does that really happen?
Well, it's one of these funny news stories that is being repeated time after time with different names of the protagonists. And one story is, of course, that the ambulance crashes on the way to the morgue, and then the coffin falls out into the road, and a squeaky voice is saying, "I'm not dead, don't bury me." And another story has an Italian jump out of his coffin inside the church and run out of the church dressed only in his shroud, screaming dismally that he is not really dead and he doesn't want to be buried. So there are a variety of funny newspaper stories today on that theme, and some of them are repeated time after time in the cheap tabloid press, both here and in America, with the different names given to the protagonists.
That's interesting. It's kind of like an urban legend that kind of perpetuates itself. Well, I know you have a great deal of other books out. I mean, this is a fascinating topic. I mean, for example, I think that we talked about briefly, I mentioned Murder Houses of London. I believe that is your latest, and you've done quite a few books since Buried Alive, haven't you?
I have done almost a book a year throughout my 20-year literary career, and my most recent book is, in fact, called The Rivals of the Ripper.
Oh, okay.
It was out in just a few months ago, and it's about unsolved murders of women in late Victorian London. So at the same time of Jack the Ripper, quite a few other interesting murder cases took place in London, and I have chronicled 14 of them in the book. And then we have Murder House of London, which is actually a trilogy. So Murder House of London, Murder House of South London, and Murder House of Greater London, published in 2014 and 2015, about the still-standing houses in London where famous historical murders once took place. And London's oldest murder house is from 1800. It's an old pub in Bayswater where a soldier was murdered by another soldier during a drunken brawl. And there are quite a few of other early murder houses, since the architecture of London is quite well preserved. There are quantities of Georgian and Victorian houses still standing, from the grand houses in Belgravia or Mayfair to the humble little terraces in Fulham or Hammersmith. And some of these houses have terrible secrets. For example, the Tooting Horror. Tooting is a suburb of London, quite far to the south, and one little house in Fountain Road, which has since been renumbered, but I know the number and I have a photo of the house. In there was enacted the Tooting Horror of 1895. So a desperate father murdered his wife and six of his seven children before committing suicide. So a dreadful cataclysm in that peaceful little terraced house down in South London. And after the mass murder, all the furniture of the house was dragged out and it was burned in a ceremony. But they couldn't very well pull down the house itself because it was part of a terrace or similar properties. So instead, the houses were renumbered. But it was possible to elucidate which house it was. And there is still a legend in that part of London that one of the houses is found in Fountain Road is haunted, and no lodger would stay there because the doors open and shut on their own account.
Oh my, well, very interesting. Jan, where can people find all of your books if they're interested in learning more about Buried Alive and all of the other things you've done?
Well, they should go into www.amazon.com because there they have all the books with reviews and various comments describing them from Buried Alive onwards.
Very good. Jan Bondesen, thank you for joining us so much today on the program.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I really enjoyed our talk with Dr. Jan Bondesen on this fascinating subject. And also thanks once again to Nick Redfern talking about Weapons of the Gods. And that does it for this week's Paranormal Podcast. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. I hope you'll also go over and check out our friends over at Club W. Go over to clubw.com/Jim. And then also our friends over at Scott E. Vest, jimherald.com/vest. We thank you so much for tuning in this week, and we hope that you'll do the same thing. Please rate and review the shows wherever you may listen, whether it's iTunes or one of the other services out there. We're now on Spotify and Google Play Music, so it's very exciting to see how the shows are gaining a wider audience and growing all the time. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.